Welcome to Dear Prudence. I'm your Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Today, we'll be offering advice on how to handle unwanted comments about Ozempic-fueled weight loss, how to get people to stop talking so much, and how to survive the trauma associated with seeing a person with tattoos and underarm hair at a wedding. Here to help me out is the writer and podcaster, Aubrey Gordon, who you may also know as Your Fat Friend. Her first book is What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat, and her second is the New York Times bestseller, You Just Need to Lose Weight and 19 Other Myths About Fat People. She's also the co-host of the Maintenance Phase podcast. Welcome to the show, Aubrey.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a joy.
I'm thrilled to have you here. I'm absolutely thrilled. You're definitely one of those people who I feel like I already know because I've heard your voice over the years for
so
long.
Back at you, buddy.
Yeah. And we're seeing each other eye to eye for the first time here on Zoom. So
yeah. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
What a joy. You are one of the people that I have with like very little basis, a great deal of Twitter fondness for.
Oh, that means
it's like a real breath of fresh air on, in the middle of like a car fire is what it feels like right now. So I'm like, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Now, yeah, I've been following your work for so, so long. And actually, we had a chance to work together on a couple of your essays before, too. So.
We did. Thank you so much for that.
And now we just get to mind other people's business together.
Let's do it.
Before we get started, I want to ask you for one piece of unsolicited advice.
Ooh. Here's one I will say that is, it's a little one. It's an easy one. It will make your day better. It will make other people's days better. Pass along compliments. If you hear someone complimented and they are not present to hear that compliment, make it a point to text it to them or call them and tell them or DM them or whatever and tell them the nice thing that somebody else said about them. Because that's like the highest strength. That's like threat level red compliment, right? Like that's like the best, strongest compliment we've got is if you're not in the room, right? Like there's so much sort of heft to that. And also then you get to experience that person's reaction to knowing that people are saying nice things to them.
Right.
And like you get a boost and they get a boost. What a joy.
And not that this should be your primary reason for doing it, but it makes people like you more.
Sure.
And trust you more.
That's also true.
Like if you're always talking shit about people behind their backs, then everyone will think you're also talking about them. And if you're always giving compliments, then people will be like, oh, this is a really genuine person. And actually, you and I are completely aligned right now because I was recently on a different podcast. It was a LinkedIn podcast. And I had a feeling they might ask me for a general piece of advice, and they didn't. But mine was going to be to tell people the nice things you say behind their backs.
I love that.
And that's I haven't good. Heard a lot of other people say that. I think it's like, it's just such a great little life improving, good vibes creating, practically free thing to do.
Totally. Couldn't agree more. So glad we're having a weird podcast mind meld.
Yeah. Anyway, Aubrey and I will dive into your questions after a short break. Can't get enough Dear Prudence? Then you should definitely join Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. You'll get to hear me answer an extra question every week just for members. With your subscription, you get ad-free listening across the Slate network and unlimited reading on the Slate site, including all Dear Prudence columns, past and present. Go to slate.com/prudyplus to sign up. It's just $15 for your first 3 months. Again, that's slate.com/prudyplus. Welcome back. You're listening to Dear Prudence, and I'm here with Aubrey Gordon. Let's get started with our first letter. It's titled, Stressed in Texas.
I have a 24-year-old niece who was estranged from family for 5 years. She's come back, moved near us, and wants to be family again. In her new life, she fancies herself a hippie, complete with facial piercings, multiple visible tattoos, and full underarm hair. My daughter is a professional attorney and plans a June wedding to a lovely professional doctor. Many of their associates will be in attendance. The niece is excited to attend. Our whole family is stressing that Peace, her new name, will take the attention away from the bride with her appearance, perhaps in a dress that shows her tats and hair. We fear that, one, she will generate comments and stares, and two, if our family hears comments, we will have to defend her and possibly cause issues. Can you please tell us a way to get us through this debacle? I'm beginning to resent her for the situation she has placed on us during a time that should be exciting and joyful. We are all stressed to the max.
So, confession. This letter is actually so silly and tone deaf and seemingly from 30 years ago that I kind of thought it might be a fake. At the same time, I couldn't resist including it because I just thought it would be fun to hear you rant about this person.
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, reporting to you live from the ancestral homeland of people who rename themselves Peace and have underarm hair and visible tattoos. Mm-hmm. I'm in Portland, Oregon. So, take that with a grain of salt. I will say, I started reading this and really was stretching myself to like take it on its own terms and be like, I'm not from Texas. I'm not a person who is desiring of getting married at any point in my life. I'm not like, this is all sort of like outside of my realm of experience. And I just couldn't get past like, hey, so then what happens to you? If a person shows up to a wedding with tattoos, then what happens? It sounds like this person thinks people will talk. So people talk. Then what happens? You feel compelled to defend this person. Then what happens, right? There's sort of no upshot as far as I can tell for the letter writer. It just seems like discomfort with the way this person has changed their appearance and maybe projecting that onto other people. This non-specific we that comes up. We are all stressed to the max. I'm like, ooh, this sounds like people I know who are just very stressed themselves and then say we to make it seem bigger. Uh-oh.
And also, imagine this being a debacle in your life.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Anticipating someone seeing someone else's armpit hair and then, like you said, then what might happen?
Love to have bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I mean, I answer a lot of petty and small questions and I get it. Not every letter is asking me to solve the world's biggest and deepest and most serious problems. But I will say that probably unrelatable to me, you, and most people who listen to this podcast, the concerns in this letter are, I actually think they do reflect some common anxieties that people have about weddings and what I think is the wrong way to think about them. Many people overestimate how much people want to be invited to their weddings or the weddings that they're planning. Big exception for people who are 2 to 7 years out of college and have a really fun group of friends where a wedding is a huge, amazing party. They probably really want to come. But for everyone else, like most of your guest list is going there to support you, not because they're dying to be there. So if there's someone who you would prefer not to see, don't think you're ruining their life by just not including them. I have a feeling that Peace has a lot cooler things to do than sit and eat chicken and green beans with a bunch of stuffy people. I just don't think this is Peace's idea of a great time. So just keep that in mind and keep in mind that you're choosing to invite her. She's not making you invite her and she's not asking to be invited. So if you do want to invite her, like it's your choice and she's not doing this to you. Also, I just think people overestimate what will happen if people see something that's unusual to them or encounter someone who's unlike them or have any kind of disagreement or conflict at a wedding. Like you said, it's not as if as a result, everyone's going to get up and leave. It's not as if they're going to stand up and object during the vows because they saw someone whose armpit hair they didn't like. In the course of our daily lives, we see a lot of people who we judge. I judge people all the time. I'm sure this letter writer does. And you just kind of do the judgment and maybe exchange a look with your friend or your date at the wedding, maybe say a little something and just keep going. It's part of life and it really is okay.
Yeah. And Peace is a person who lives in Texas or has family in Texas and has gotten tattoos and still lives sort of in the orbit of these folks. Right. So like, that's also a decision that Peace is making and can make. I mean, the other thing I would flag here is this is not the letter writer's wedding. Right. Someone else is making decisions. The letter writer's daughter is making decisions about who to invite and who not to invite, what kind of event they want. The letter writer's daughter is deciding to invite their like lawyer colleagues, right? And potentially also this cousin. So if the letter writer's daughter, the actual person who's getting married, doesn't see a problem here, then I think it's not anybody else's place to like insist that there must be. Does that make sense?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And keep in mind, the letter writer is saying the daughter is a professional attorney and her spouse is a professional doctor. So not just a recreational attorney, but a professional one.
Not rec league medicine.
Real, real professional.
Shirts and skins.
Even so. Attorneys. Right. Even given that they're professionals, open your mind to the possibility that people who have been to law school or medical school have also seen tattoos before, had friends with tattoos, maybe have children with dyed hair, maybe have their own armpit hair. It's not this separate class of super formal, stuffy people. It's just a job.
That's right. I mean, this is the thing that comes up with my mom and I. I'm a person who has tattoos. And I think some of this is genuinely very generational as well. That like, I think that my mom and a number of her friends think of getting a tattoo as like, well, now you'll never get a job again. Right? Yeah. Without understanding how ubiquitous that is amongst my age group and younger, without understanding that a bunch of tattoo regulations have like changed and some places have actually banned discrimination on the basis of having or not having tattoos, right? Like there are like things going on here that have led to like a generational shift. So I also think like, this seems like a real case of like, I know it's a wedding. I know this person said something about like, help us get through this time that's supposed to be so joyful. And I was like, yeah, weddings famously stress-free. What are we talking about here? What are we talking about?
Right.
But like, I would just like urge the letter writer to think about like, this is an event that your daughter is making for, you know, the beginning of the next chapter of your daughter's life, right? It's her event to plan, therefore it's your event to attend or not attend, right? Right.
And I'm guessing, it doesn't say it, but I'm guessing the letter writer is paying for a lot of it. And possibly having some input there.
Totally.
That said, it's still your daughter's event. I think it would be good to just set an intention for the day. So as the mother of the bride, and I assume the person who's writing some checks, what are your intentions for the year leading up to this and all the money you're putting in and how you hope everyone will feel coming out? And I would suggest replacing that everyone comes away holding me and my entire family in high regard according to these really strict old-fashioned standards that I've made up, and replacing that with that my daughter marries the love of her life and is celebrated by her community and feels supported. And when you make that your intention, you'll realize that a lot of the other things stop mattering as much.
Totally. And whether or not you're worried about a single guest, you're job, I would hope, right? Your job as a parent of a person getting married is to make that person feel special and supported all day long and like do what you can to make that a reality just in how you show up. Just in how you show up, not in how anybody else shows up, just in sort of your own being. And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff that you can do. Even if you are genuinely concerned that someone else will like upstage your kid on their wedding day or what have you, there are a bunch of things that you can do to sort of drown that out, right? And to make it really, really special for them.
Yeah. And if you do feel like you need an event that speaks to your sensibilities and that is specifically tailored to your worldview, you can have an amazing 70th birthday, retirement party, 50th anniversary party. All of those things are available to you to pick the exact people you want to be there and set a strict dress code and like see the vision that you want to see. But that's probably not the right goal for this event.
We're aligned. We're entirely aligned here. Keep it moving. That's the message.
Good luck to Peace. Good luck to Peace, who's probably a really tolerant person. You're listening to the Dear Prudence Show, and when we come back, we'll be reading more of your letters. Stay with us. Welcome back to Dear Prudence. I'm here with my guest, Aubrey Gordon, and the next letter we'll be answering is titled, Thanks, I Guess.
Over the pandemic, I, 40 female, ate a lot of junk. I was unsurprised when a year later, my doctor diagnosed me with type 2 diabetes. I was borderline prior to that. For that first year, despite losing weight, my A1C was not the best. After a discussion with my doctor, we agreed I should go on Ozempic. Despite the significant side effects, it worked, and my A1C came down to a much more acceptable range. I also lost a lot of weight. Despite being on it for a year, I continued to lose the weight. I've joked that at least half of that was due to the side effects, vomiting primarily. But here is the thing. Despite the meds, I'm not doing anything differently than I did a year ago. How do I handle people who are commenting on my weight loss, especially coworkers or people I'm not friends with? Since there is now a bit of a stigma around Ozempic, and I don't typically share my health information with people, I never know what to say. People have asked what I'm doing and say how good I look. I just smile and nod, but it makes for a moment of awkwardness. The answer is I'm not really doing anything. Plus, while I don't mind losing the weight, I was happy at the weight that I was previously. Is there a good way to answer these questions?
So I picked this question because you and Michael did a whole episode of Maintenance Phase about Ozempic. If people want to listen to it, I think it was October 2023, I believe. And you really unpacked it all. But two things that I thought related to this question that you touched on were the stigma around weight loss medications and how just discussions about weight and body image overall can end up being harmful even when it's not intentional. So I don't know, is there anything you want to put on the record about that stuff before we really get into it?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing that I would say about Ozempic and Wegovy. As drugs, they are able to do incredible things. People who would die are less likely to die because of taking these medications. People whose A1Cs are really, really high and putting them at risk of like major complications of type 2 diabetes are now able to access treatment because of that. But that's not the thing that we've been culturally flipping out about. We've been culturally flipping out about a bunch of people seeming thinner and like using that as grist for the gossip mill about what kinds of medications people are or are not accessing. That means there's a bunch of chatter about Ozempic, which I think people experience as stigma for taking it. I just want to be really clear. Rapidly dropping weight is not a stigmatized thing in our culture.
No, it's
not. It's a celebrated thing, and you might feel more attention because of that. And folks might pass some judgment because of that here and there. But for the most part, when people lose weight, they are received as this person is with like huge open arms, everyone assuming it's the best thing ever, right?
Yeah.
And no one really thinking, I wonder if this person's developed an eating disorder, or I wonder if this person's going through chemotherapy, or I wonder if this person just went through a divorce, which are all also common reasons for significant weight loss. So like step one for our listeners, let's reframe that part. And then we can like dig in on this specific letter writer who we got layers. We got layers to work through here.
Yeah. And there is also this, I don't know if you would call it stigma or judgment, but the attitude that people who have lost weight as the result of taking weight loss medication somehow did it the easy way or cheated.
Yeah.
Which I think is another thing that one is dumb.
Yep.
But I think the letter writer doesn't want to have applied to them.
Yep, totally. Which I would say, once again, that's not a stigma about taking weight loss medications. That's like ricochet anti-fat bias that you're experiencing. Because what people are pushing for isn't necessarily just for you to lose weight. What they're pushing for, and this is like sad and dark, but true, as foretold by the prophet, the Biggest Loser, people really just want to see fat people suffer as a result of being fat. That is the thing that people are pushing for. And when they see people dropping weight and not performing some kind of suffering for them, it makes people really upset. But that's because they expect fat people to make them feel better about themselves,
right?
And that's where that's coming from, which I don't think is quite the same thing as a stigma for using a drug, right? Like there are drugs that are very clearly stigmatized. Opioids, I would say at this point, very clearly stigmatized, right? I don't know that Ozempic, with as many breathless headlines and like, is this the end of the obesity epidemic sort of framing as we have? Like, I'm not sure that I would slot that in quite the same category as stigma.
Yeah, no, definitely. I feel like the letter writer wants to avoid that ricochet.
Totally.
Anti-fat.
Totally. Hate. Understandably.
And also, I think there are a couple of things. The letter writer wants privacy, wants to be able to mind her own business. The letter writer doesn't want to have to explain her health history. She doesn't want any of the negative feelings people might have about the weight loss drugs or about the ability to lose weight without being miserable and suffering. So I think the first thing I would say is that it's completely okay to continue to be evasive or even snarky, or if it's in your personality to make people feel weird for asking invasive questions. So it depends on who you are and, you know, how you're built. But you could say anything from, you know, thanks, I'm not doing anything intentional, to it was a side effect of a health issue I'm dealing with, and I was actually happy at my previous weight, but thanks for the compliment. And I do want to acknowledge that I don't think people are being unkind here. I just think that our society is getting closer to a consensus that you don't go up to people and talk about their bodies. I think that would be a great rule if everyone could embrace it. But where people are still catching up is when it comes to saying positive things, or things that you, the speaker, think are positive that may or may not be perceived as positive to the person who's receiving them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think you can also say things like, I looked great before too, thanks. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds of stuff that you can say.
Yeah.
I think it's worth noting, the person who's commenting on your body is the person creating the uncomfortable situation. You're not the person creating the uncomfortable situation. So I think it's okay to say things that like makes them hold that discomfort, right? And I think all of the things that you listed are like perfect examples of that, of just being like, I don't actually talk about my body with people, right? The other thing that I would say here, so like step one is nobody else should be commenting about your body. They're doing it because they think it's a compliment, because they think being fat is terrible. And any escape from fatness is like, must be a net positive, right? So like step one, nobody should be talking about your body. Step two, as with anyone who is undergoing or has undergone major weight loss, I would really, really, really encourage this letter writer to sit with and think about and update their own ideas about fatness and about diabetes in particular. They've got some stuff in here that is really scientifically wrongheaded.
Oh, wow. Say more.
Eating junk food and eating sugar doesn't actually give people diabetes. This is like a very, very, very common misconception. It's not a bunch of people eating like quote unquote bad foods who then give themselves a chronic health condition. It's one of the most prevalent health conditions in the country. And it's a pretty big mystery what causes it. We don't even totally know how many types there are yet, right? So like, just like heads up, there's some scientifically shaky stuff here. I would also say losing weight alone does not necessarily lower someone's A1C. You have to focus on your blood sugar to lower your blood sugar, and weight changes may or may not come along with that. I would just counsel this person to check that kind of stuff, because while you're trying to dodge all of the bullets of anti-fat sort of bias ricochet around you, that stuff's going to end up hitting some fat people in the process. And you're going to end up saying some things that end up hitting fat people in the process too, right? Like the implication, it's sticky because it's your own body and your own experience, but there is a clear implication here that people who have diabetes do it to themselves, and people who have diabetes just got too fat and became diabetic. And we know that both of those things are not, like, that's not how that operates, right? So like, I would just really, really encourage this person to revisit those beliefs so that they're not reinforcing the system they're trying to escape, right? So that they're not encouraging judgment of people who did it differently than them, so that they're not encouraging judgment of other people who have diabetes or other people who are or used to be fat people, whatever the case may be. I just would like really, really urge this person to sort of dig down underneath that, because there is a lot of weight loss happening out in the world right now, a lot of pretty dramatic weight loss, some of it due to Ozempic and Wegovy, some of it not. That in itself is not a problem. What is a problem is when people feel themselves moving from an out-group to an in-group and start doing things to distance themselves from their former out-group status. Like, I ate a lot of junk food and that's why I got diabetes, so I'm not totally surprised, right? Which is a pretty gnarly worldview to paint other diabetic people into and other fat people into. And I actually think, Janae, a thing that you said earlier of like, I'm not doing anything intentional, is a really powerful thing for people to hear, because it is really true that most of the time, most of our weight is just like out of our control, right? So I think there's a great deal of power in that, and would just encourage, in addition to this sort of quick fix of like, just tell people to knock it off, basically, you know, politely tell them to knock it off. I think the flip side of that is I would just urge this person to like sit with their own stuff and their own narrative around their health condition and their weight, and figure out whether they intend to or not, what the telling of that story ends up implying about people with different experiences.
This is Dear Prudence. We need to take a break, but when we come back, more letters from you and advice from us. Stay tuned. I'm Janae, and you're listening to Dear Prudence. Aubrey, are you ready for our last question of the day?
The readiest.
It's titled All Ears.
I'm writing with a problem I've experienced since my very first adult job, working in a reference desk at a college library. How do you get people to stop talking? Not every person, just the kind of person that tells a story and then tells another story related to the first and another, etc. The kind of person who seems to forget the conversation is a two-way street and who doesn't recognize signals like standing up, slowly backing away, walking away, or even saying, I have to go now. They will sometimes follow you to the bathroom door, still talking. At first I thought this was a job hazard of working in a public-facing desk, and then I thought it had to do with the part of the country I was in, but these people are everywhere. I have read that one tactic is to comment on the last thing they said and then quickly change the subject, but these people have an evolved immunity even to that one. Help. Oh, help.
Okay, so normally when I receive a letter like this, it's about one specific person. It's about the colleague in the cubicle next door, or it's about the neighbor who's always there when you go to your car. I find it curious that this letter writer is dealing with people who won't stop talking all the time and everywhere.
I will say this is something that I have experienced in my life. Mm-hmm. Of just and with love to this letter writer, we are the problem. We're the common denominator here, right? I think for me, without speaking to this letter writer and sort of all of what's going on with them, but just to like flesh it out on my own end, I really struggle with not wanting to be seen as rude, which means I end up acting like a doormat pretty often, which means I don't give people the same amount of like social cues to stop stuff that other people might give more readily and more directly. So I would like say, step one, if that's also an issue for you, you got to be willing to move off of that being perceived as rude thing.
What are some of the social cues that a regular person would give that you're just not comfortable giving?
I would say I've gotten considerably better about it now, but like, I think stuff like physically walking away or saying, I'm so sorry, I don't have time to talk right now, I gotta go, right? Like just being super direct and saying, I'm so sorry, I have to work right, I can't talk right now, I have to work.
Yeah.
You want to talk another time? exactly. You know what I mean? Like, because the other thing that is sort of like a potential thing happening here is, listen, you could be talking to people who just haven't been told no very much in their lives. That's a distinct possibility. You could also be talking to people who are experiencing some level of neurodivergence and are not reading social cues in the same way that you are expecting them to, right? Mm-hmm. Either way, whatever the genesis of that thing is, you're not doing that person a service by withholding feedback from them.
Right.
Right. Like you're not actually like helping that person or yourself by not just being like, hey, I can't talk right now.
Yeah.
So sorry. Got to run. Talk to you later.
Right. And the letter writer does say they're saying I have to go now. So there's that. But I think maybe you need to combine tactics, like saying I have to go now and then actually going.
Yep, totally. And like a thing that you learn about. So I spent a long time as a community organizer. And one of the things that you talk about in community organizing is escalation of tactics. That you start by politely asking for what you want. And if you don't get it from politely asking, then you sort of ratchet it up and ratchet it up and ratchet it up, right? So I wonder if this is something that's showing up at work in particular, like maybe you set a policy depending on the kind of job that you have. If you're in like an office setting of like, hey, you need to make an appointment on my calendar and then we can talk. And that's how I do it. And that's how much time I book. The end.
Yeah. I mean, work should really be the easiest setting. Like, I'm so sorry. I have to get back to work. I can't talk.
Yeah.
Totally. Is universally accepted.
Totally.
In public, if you want a really practical idea, headphones. Maybe you need the big noise canceling ones instead of AirPods, just to give a really clear visual symbol.
Yep.
And just a slight positive spin on this. So I always share the TikTok rabbit holes that I'm going down. So a theme that I've been looking into is these women, it's almost always women, who give tips on how to become magnetic. How to become magnetic to men and women who want to be friends with you and make people want to give you things. And it's all kind of silly stuff, like give yourself positive affirmations. Make sure your nails are done nicely. Okay. Have good posture. But the idea is that if you do all these things, you walk into a room, people are drawn to you. They want to be in your presence. They want to talk to you. They want to give you free things. So it's possible, letter writer, and I would say this might apply to Aubrey, who's really delightful and charming, you may just be a really magnetic person. You may just be someone who people want to be around. Like, there's a positive side of this. There's a lot of people out there who are not getting talked to and who are lonely. And so there's something about you, whether it's being empathetic, being interesting, being kind, or just giving off a vibe that makes people want to be around you, that's causing these people to want to be in conversation with you.
I will also say, listen, part of my I'm the problem take here is that there are times when I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah,
I have a handful of stories about like somebody coming to the house to work on the plumbing who ended up staying for 3 hours and tried to tell me about the time that he said his dad told Lady Bird Johnson to fuck off. And I was like, so that definitely didn't happen, but I want to hear this entire story. Tell me
it's
now,
like that
please.
Meme about like the person who gets in the Uber and 5 minutes later, they're like, good luck with the custody case.
Totally,
I'm believing you.
Totally.
I know things are going to work out in your favor.
Yes, that is absolutely me. So I also think it's like totally fine and normal to be like, what am I getting out of this? Am I getting something out of it? Do I want to draw it out? And I think I've also just like become comfortable on some level that there are times when I want to draw it out. When the guy shows up to install my internet and wants to recommend a series of anti-vax documentaries to me, I want him to talk to me about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I'm just like,
you're curious.
Sure, man, let's roll.
Right.
So I also think just like, be honest with yourself about what you do and don't want, and then find ways to be honest with other people too.
Yeah. Lean into the interactions where you feel like the person that has something interesting to say, because some of these people must, or where you feel like maybe someone's experiencing a little loneliness and you're able to provide a little bit of a service by being the one person they talk to that day who really sees and hears them. I think that could feel good. And then make those interactions high quality and let them linger for a while. And then you won't feel as bad when it comes to the other ones where the person is truly just ranting and raving about something that has nothing to do with you. And you have to say, I'm so sorry. I have to get back to work. I'm putting my headphones on now. Okay, those are all the questions we have for this week. It's been fun and hopefully helpful. Thank you so much, Aubrey.
Thank you for having me. This is such a joy.
It was really, really great having you here. Follow Aubrey on Instagram and Twitter at yourfatfriend. That's YR fatfriend. And listen to and subscribe to her podcast, Maintenance Phase, wherever you get your podcasts. Do you need help getting along with partners, relatives, coworkers, and people in general? Write to me. Go to slate.com/prudy. That's slate.com/PRUDIE. The Dear Prudence column publishes every Thursday.
If you'd like to hear your question answered on the podcast, we are looking for letter writers who would be comfortable recording their questions for the show. You can stay anonymous.
Dear Prudence is produced by Sierra Spragley Ricks and me, Janae Desmond Harris, with a special thanks to Maura Curry. Editorial help from Paola De Verona. Daisy Rosario is senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. I'm your Dear Prudence, Janae Desmond Harris. Until next time.